At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Zane, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. You may note that that is not Monegasque or French, I guess they speak there, but German, in honor of the dearly departed Niki Lauda, who passed away this week. Really starting the show with kind of a bummer, but this is impossible to ignore. Niki Lauda is a titan of Formula One and has been around forever. At least as long as I've been watching, he's always been in the pits with Mercedes, and it's sad to see him go.
Yeah, I feel like we had our you know, start of the season when Charlie passed away so young. I don't know, I was kind of put back by the fact that Niki Lauda was 70 years old, because he looks older, obviously, than his years, and even that feels a little bit young. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And also sad, I actually don't know exactly how much the lung stuff is connected to his crash. I imagine it's pretty connected to it, but sad to see that it seems to have been that maybe eventually is what caught up with him. But there you go. And, you know, he kept fighting for 33 years or whatever, 43 years after the incident. So, you know, fair play.
Yeah, I think I'll say, like, it's strange because it's one of those characters who looms really large in sort of the Formula One of my father's generation, right? Like, for me, Lauda was always it's strange, but for me, Lauda was always like a long ago figure in some ways. Like, I didn't really fully appreciate the role he played in the sport or how vast and all-encompassing his career was probably into the last few years, right? When, like, there was a lot of tension on his life story via, you know, the Ron Howard movie, Rush. And it's a kind of... It's wild to think about, like, him unretiring in, what, 84 to win a final world championship. And, yeah. Like, that is not as far back as I would think, right? It's the damnedest thing, but like for me, he's always sort of he's been like one of those old timers, you know, the part of that golden era of F1, and actually, like, it was just out of my experience, right? But it is what my dad grew up, you know, watching and getting into as a teenager and young man.
Yeah, Danny, you've compiled a sort of a greatest hits of Niki Lauda. Do you want to go through it right now?
Yeah, sure. I tried to, I don't know, get a sense of the man, the racer and the person, where he's from and all that he achieved in life on the track and off. So I've just compiled a little bit of a collection of anecdotes from his earlier life. His name is Andreas Nicholas Lauda. Andreas was actually his real name, Niki being his nickname we all came to know him by. He came from sort of rich stock in Austria and Vienna. His grandfather was an industrialist. And the family wasn't particularly happy with the fact that he didn't go into the family business and went off driving motor cars, which certainly, you know, back in the 60s and 70s would have been less of a prestigious job than even today. He drove in Mini first and then Formula V, which is kind of like a you know, those old style kind of cylindrical open wheel cars, and then he took out a loan to join the March team, which is a Formula One and Formula Two team in 1971. He took out, I think it was a life insurance policy against himself, is what he had funded the loan with, and he drove so well in 71 that he got promoted to their F1 team the following year. He then took out another bank loan to join BRM in 73 because the March team, I guess, did well in Formula 2, but not so much in F1. And it was there that he met his teammate, Clay Regazzoni, who then ended up, of course, going to Ferrari, sort of vouched for Nicky. And then Nicky got to join Ferrari in 74, only 3 years after entering the sport. And also the money he got from that deal ended up helping him clear all his debts and wipe the slate clean. He did well in 74, but 75 was when he won the championship, his first ever championship in that car. 76 then, he was leading the championship when he had his crash, which is obviously where he got the scars that most people will remember him looking like in the preceding years. He actually had, it happened at the Nürburgring on the second lap, he had famously boycotted the rest of the drivers to he had lobbied them to boycott the race because there was a worry similar to Spa sort of around those times that the breadth of the track, especially when their access to the Nordschleife and stuff, was just kind of too big and there wasn't enough people to help you if you crashed, and just generally there was a lot of concrete walls and stuff. He crashed obviously famously, the footage is out there if you want to go check it out yourself. Brett Lunger's Ford also crashed into him while his car was on fire. He lost his right ear, he had third degree burns, his helmet came off, which is why the flames were sort of everywhere, his fire suit wasn't protecting him, and they gave him the last rites in hospital after they pulled him out of the car. But incredibly he powered through it, got his lungs pumped, returned 2 races later, bandaged, wearing a cap, which he famously got the sponsors to pay millions, I think it was, in the end, to put their logo on his cap, which sort of, I don't know, I feel like that was maybe the start of the cap thing.
Yeah, good lord.
In racing, which is pretty amazing. And he also talked about how scared he was. He was terrified to get back in the car. But he did, and himself and, you know, James Hunt, I think at that stage had gone ahead in the, it's all spoilers for the movie, by the way, had gone ahead in the championship. And then even, I think there was a sort of a sense of the man as somebody who was brave even then, but not stupid, when he retired from that final race in Japan, effectively handing the championship to Hunt. His tear ducts were badly damaged in the fire and they were sort of watering his eyes too much and he couldn't see very well. I guess it soured his relationship with Ferrari a little bit. The next year he won again in 77, but he didn't enjoy being with the team. So he moved to Brabham for 2 seasons, which was pretty much, the only memorable part from that part of his career was the fact that he was the guy who drove the fan car that one race.
Oh man. Yeah.
Which was Bernie Eccleston's fan car, by the way. There was a sort of a confluence of big personalities in that, which they used for one race and then got rid of it before.
I think Bernie even at that stage. It's amazing. It's a literal, it looks like any kind of, fan that you would have in your room just bolted to the back of a car to suck the car to the track. And of course they outlawed it, but I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's cool.
It's like one of those fans you'd see in a museum on a hot day where they're just trying to keep as many people cool as possible. Right. As Rob said, he retired sort of twice and came back. His last stint in the car was in 84 with McLaren when he won the championship again, which was pretty incredible. His third time in 84. So 75, 77, and 84. And then he drifted away. He went off and did this. He was very interested in lots of other types of, I guess, you know, sport and mechanics and stuff. And he had a great love of flight. He got his commercial license and he started a number of different airlines, actually. Lauda Air, another one called Niki, another one called Lauda Motion. Some of these were sort of like bought by German and Austrian airline companies. Other ones he got back after they went insolvent. It's sort of a complicated little story there, and he also flew them as well because he had his license. But he did return.
I have a story
to,
from that. Go on. I just wanted to interject here. With I didn't hear this until people started sharing the best Niki Lauda stories. But apparently, so one of his planes, a Lauda Air Flight 004, crashed in 1991, and Lauda and Boeing were going back and forth, like pointing fingers at each other. And this is from the Wikipedia page on the crash. Lauda stated, quote, "What really annoyed me was Boeing's reaction once the cause was clear. Apparently, the thrust reverser deployed in flight. Lauda says Boeing did not want to say anything. So Boeing is kind of saying, like, well, it could have been pilot error. Back to Wikipedia. Lauda asked for a press conference the following day and told Boeing that if it was possible to recover, he would be willing to fly a 767 with two pilots and have the thrust reverser deploy in air. Boeing told Lauda that it was not possible. So Lauda asked Boeing to issue a statement saying that it would not be survivable, and Boeing issued it. Lauda then added, this was the first time in 8 months it had been made clear that the manufacturer, Boeing, was at fault and not the operator of the airplane. So he basically, like, called their bluff and said, oh, you don't think this is your fault? Well, I'll go up there, hit the reverser, and we'll see if it's survivable or not.
Wow, that's so, yeah, the kind of a couple of different shades of his personality there. The fact that he never stepped down from a fight, clever, communicator, and also just fucking brave. That's awesome. I mean, he became, when he returned to F1, he had a couple of different stints, actually. He was a consultant at Ferrari for a year. He was team principal at Jaguar right before they shut down, so he didn't last very long there. And then, of course, became non-executive chairman of Mercedes, was instrumental in the signing of Lewis Hamilton. And that's when he kind of became part, again, of the conversation around F1. Like, I'm same as Rob. Like, to me, he was, like a Fittipaldi or someone. He was an old-timer who had been in the sport, who was outside of my era, even though he was a couple of years before Senna, basically, at least at the end of his career. But of course, that's when we all sort of got to re-know him. The only other thing he got from his airline business was his second wife and a pair of twins as well. He has two children from his first marriage to Marlene, Mateus Lauda, who is a driver. He did touring car and a couple of other stuff. And Luca, who actually was Mateus's manager for a number of years as well in driving. But Brigitte was an air hostess who worked for Lauda Air, who he met then I think he was divorced in the late 70s and remarried in the late 90s or something. She not only gave him, oh no, I was thinking it was a couple of years later. She not only gave him, obviously a wonderful marriage as well, but, she gave him one of his kidneys. He had two kidney replacements. Actually, his brother gave him one and then she gave him a second one. And they have a pair of twins as well now who are around 10 years old. He had a lung replacement surgery in August of 2018, just last year, less than a year ago. I guess that was sort of what, perhaps was part of the reason why he was in hospital at the moment. Years and years after that initial crash and inhaling all of those terrible fumes, he managed to stick around for quite a long time and add to the story of F1 long after with two more titles and a hell of a lot of great interviews. We'll miss him a lot on television whenever he popped up. His blunt honesty and insight, I think, was always appreciated. He wasn't somebody who said a lot of words, but what he said, he sort of got to the point pretty quickly, which, always good on interviews as well.
Yeah, truly one of the greats, and we will miss him very much. And again, that his whole story is immortalized in the movie Rush, and I think we all recommend that movie.
Yeah, a couple of people saying we should maybe do a review of that one as well at some stage. Maybe it'd be good to get that one done during the...
That's a great one.
Yeah.
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 I always did have the feeling that it's tough to know what to make of people who've moved into those kind of power broker roles, which is very much, I think, what his modern involvement in F1 has been to an extent, which, it's funny to think about. He has connections to both, he bridges the gap between the Jaguar operation and Red Bull, and then, obviously he's been instrumental in kind of Mercedes' rise to this point. And I always did wonder how heavily he had to get involved when things were running off the rails with Hamilton and Rosberg. That was there was a period of time there where I always get what was it? It was Spa, right? Where Rosberg hit Hamilton and cut his tire. And then after the race, you called into the principal's office it was always like Toto and Nicky, right, trying to talk to the drivers and figure out what was going on. And so I do kind of wonder if that was a, you know, because we talk sometimes about how tough it must be to manage talents like this, right? Like, how many people can empathize with what an F1 driver goes through? Yeah. How many people can really understand the mindset of a multiple world champion like a Lewis Hamilton, right? Niki Lauda is one of the few people who can probably bridge that gap. And I think now Mercedes overall is in a better place. I think it's a more peaceful house. But at the start of this era, that was a team I think was very much in danger of throwing away its own advantages because the internal politics were so fraught and tense. And I always did wonder how much Lauda's influence kept them from boiling over versus how much was, you know, the maturity of the drivers or Toto Wolff's skill at handling it.
Totally. And how many people on the planet exist that would be able to, that like somebody like Lewis Hamilton or Nico Rosberg would actually listen to, like,
yeah,
who've been in that, been in, regardless of the, you know, experience, even there's only a couple of people. And there's, you know, even there's a lot of F1 drivers, former F drivers that people, modern drivers, wouldn't want to listen to, but he bridged that gap as well. He was, you know, sensible, and he had been in those passionate, you know, fights as well with people like Hunt. So, yeah. That's a good point, Rob.
Well, speaking of Formula One world champions, should we move on to the rest of the news, fellas?
Sure. Let's talk about Fernando Alonso for the next 30 minutes.
Yeah. Who wants to take this one? Rob, do you have a handle on this?
Oh, boy. Yes, sort of. Okay. So... this was going to be, like, right now, Alonso is in this sort of valedictory phase of his career. I think his contract with Toyota is formally wrapped up or is in the process. I think he's probably driven his last race for the Toyota Endurance program. He won his 24 Hours of Le Mans, you know, championship with them. So, you know, check that box. And he really wants to notch Indy, you know, on his belt before he before he calls it a day. And this was, you know, not maybe this was going to be the year, would be putting it too strongly, but the impression that McLaren and Alonso and the word that's been put out, you know, in the media about this year's effort was, this was kind of going to be the more serious effort, right? This was kind of a, Fernando Alonso is going to get that feather in his cap. He is going to do what so many of the greats have done. He's going to win the Indy 500. And
in a McLaren car.
In a McLaren. And I was like, okay, I'm curious to see how that works out. Like, you know, it should be exciting to see how this, you know, how this pans out. Now, I think always they overpromised because the Indy 500 is a hard fucking race. It is a hard race to win. There are so many, there is so much like random chance that can influence the result of that race. But nevertheless, they were really confident about their prospects. Apparently, they had sold a ton of advertising against this effort. Like, this was going to be a major brand building effort, and a, you know, a really kind of announcing McLaren's arrival in IndyCar kind of effort. And then Sunday, I didn't watch qualifying, so apparently I missed a lot of good stuff. But Sunday night,
well, and qualifying is a little different for the Indy 500 because when we talk about Formula One qualifying, it just sets this the order that everyone starts in. In for the Indy 500 specifically, you must actually qualify for the race. There are 33 slots, and you've got to go faster than everyone else and get into. You have to earn your place in the Indy 500, and it's not. There's no, you know, historically locked seats. You actually have to qualify for the race.
And they also do it in a different format. Obviously, they do the average lap time across those five laps?
Yeah, it's Indy's weird. The way they traditionally present that information, I think, is not lap time, but average speed.
around the oval. Okay. So if you're watching Indy qualifying, a lot of times what you'll see is not a a timestamp for quali. What you'll see is just how fast around the track were you. It's two ways of expressing the same information, but nevertheless, there tends to be a little more of a focus on your speed around Indy, which is going to come into play here in a second. But yeah, the cars go very fast at Indy. It's a high sustained rate of speed. And by Sunday, it turns out Alonso did not qualify. He was not going to be in it. And that was shocking enough. But what was more shocking was how much information leaked out, like, immediately. Not even leaked out. I guess Zach Brown basically got ahead of this by laying out what happened. But what happened is a bad story. Like, it's amazing they just owned up to all this, because the facts as Zach Brown laid them out were...
CEO of McLaren.
Yeah. Mm. They were disastrous. So where to begin? First things first. So they partnered with another team, Carlin, which also runs a number of entrants in IndyCar races. Patricio Ward, I think, is one of their drivers. They partner with Carlin to provide their spare car. And apparently, Carlin delivered a car, but it showed up in the wrong color of orange, the wrong shade of orange. So now if you remember the Amazon documentary on McLaren, one thing we do know about Zach Brown is the branding better be perfect. And it just has to be, that car has to match the branding guidelines, and has to have lots of good, like, display space for advertising. Anyway,
papaya orange. Yeah, very important, Rob.
That was the correct color. Carlin didn't deliver a car in papaya orange. So, and this is the wild part. Apparently, at that point, that car was put into, like, a garage and forgotten about. And it eventually made its way into a painting facility, but it was still getting its paint job finished, or it was letting the paint set, when testing began, which again is going to come up. So they got the car, they weren't happy with the color. And then I don't know what the decision was. They just kind of put it on back burner and moved on. Eventually it would get painted. So then other issues begin cropping up. Apparently they didn't have a steering wheel.
So you need one of those.
Yeah. Which I guess I didn't realize that, like, the steering wheel, like, the people build you the car, nobody's building you the steering wheel. That's a separate part. They didn't have...
Yeah, Logitech does the wheel. Yeah. You got to go to PC World.
You
got to
make sure
computer.
You have the Xbox or the PlayStation one, but you have to know which one is which. No. So apparently, literally, there was not a wheel, like, a week before the race. And so, again, like, Zach Brown, I gather, had to go to Cosworth, I want to say. And... like, get a wheel. Like literally go there and pick one
up. Why does he have to do... Why, like... I guess we'll get to this, but I'm sorry. Keep going.
Yeah, and he said that's where this whole thing fell down in project management. Zach Brown should not be digging around for steering wheels. Zach Brown speaks in the third person about himself. But... And so this was also him saying that the person who was heading up this McLaren Indy effort was Bob Fernley. That person was... basically fired. McLaren says the contract was up, but clearly they were quick to say, like, in the wake of all this, Bob Fernley would not be coming back. So they had no steering wheel. Zach Brown has to go and, like, I guess cash in some favors and literally go pick one up himself. And then Alonso has a crash in testing. Mm. And they need the Carlin car. And it is not, the paint job is not finished. And so everything is basically frozen as far as what, like, you know, he needs another car. Every other driver on the grid just hops in the spare. McLaren doesn't have a spare. And there's a brutal, like, paddock diary in USA Today about, like, literally what the scene was in the McLaren pits before all this. And, again, it was just chaos. People, like, frantically trying to slap this car together. They're running out of time. They make another mistake in practice. They get the inches versus the English versus metric measurements wrong. So they send Alonso out for a test lap. And apparently the thing is just like sparking and bouncing along the ground because it's too low. Because they use the wrong units.
Oh my gosh.
I actually said, oh no, out loud when I read that part.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes, it's astonishing. So now they've kind of trashed their new car a little bit. And apparently this is the part the USA Today correspondent saw. So at that point, they are now running up and down the pits, like begging for replacement parts. They're basically trying to get help finishing their car, and to get this thing back out there. And they do, and they send him out there, and Alonso doesn't set the time. It starts to rain, so he misses out on qualifying. Turns out, after the fact, was going to be pretty unlikely that he was going to qualify because they screwed up the gear ratios, and so his car could have gone 229 miles an hour, but they only geared it up to 227.5. So
I mean, who needs the extra 1.5? It's just the cherry on top, you know.
Yeah. So anyway,
the new paint will make it go faster. It's got speed lines.
There was some debate as to whether, like, maybe McLaren would just buy someone out of their spot on the grid and just get Alonso in a seat for the race. Alonso,
which is the
shot
most
that
American
down.
Thing. The most American thing I've ever heard is buying your way on. It's like,
yeah.
Thankfully, he shot it down. I thought that was decent.
Well, yeah, decent, and also I think that would have added a further layer of humiliation. At a point, you just need to pull the plug on this. You can't then be like, okay, now we're going to kick another driver out of his spot, and Alonso's going to be a pay driver at an F1, at Indy 500? No, that's not...
And presumably, he's not really in it to win it at this stage anyway, so... And that's the only reason he's doing this, is to get that triple crown, right?
Yeah. So that is the story of McLaren's IndyCar effort. Brown wraps up. He said, you know, we really did put it all on the line. You could feel the anxiety. There's some real heroism in that. I don't want the world to think McLaren is a bunch of idiots. Because we did have a few, we had some real stars.
Oh, wow.
Also, like, one of the things Zach Brown did mention is he didn't want to blame Carlin for the job they did supporting the McLaren effort. But he did feel that maybe Carlin weren't up to the task of supporting that many entrants in the Indy 500. And that's kind of where things wrong. There's some where things went wrong. There's some evidence for that. But at the same time, that's what I've been dying to ask you all. What do you make of this? And is this yet another Zach Brown story?
I think the fact that he's the one who decided to come out and write this whole thing to me feels like a defensive maneuver, and it does seem like a project management issue. Like it's a pipeline problem, it's a communication problem, which, you know, when you watch the series that was on Netflix, was it Netflix or Amazon? I always forget which one's which.
Amazon.
Amazon, that one's, which that seemed like a big part of the problem was the way the business is set up in a broad sense, and communication problems between them and their partners. But this one is just like, when you get to the stage where somebody's having to go and hop in a car and grab a wheel from somebody, I just think, yeah, it's hard to tell exactly what happened because we're only getting his version of what happened. I imagine there was a lot of faults on McLaren's side as well. Like in terms of a lot of these instances where they're complaining about the paint and the wheel and all that sort of stuff. I have an issue trying to like make a judgment on whose fault it was, but there's only a certain amount of times when I don't know, Zach Brown's caught with, you know, shit in his pants. You gotta wonder about, you know, what's the common denominator on all these problems.
I also, just to add insult to injury, when Alonso did do that crash in practice, they put his car onto a flatbed truck with a crane. Oh. And then guess what? The crane ran into a bridge.
How does this keep happening?
Exactly like the Williams car.
Yeah, in Baku. It's like whenever you see a truck crash into a bridge, like on a road, you're like, you had one job. Like, do you not, every bridge you come to, do you not check the height thing and make sure? An absolute comedy of errors. I don't know. I mean, he says he doesn't want McLaren to look like they're a bunch of idiots. You know, you can have an underperforming team and not look like idiots, but they do look like idiots because of the way these things keep happening. The manner they happen. Like, this is just, yeah, ridiculous.
Well, from one... Go ahead, Rob.
No, I was just going to say, it's... I wonder... There is a great deal of ambiguity, for me at least, as to what Zach Brown's job actually is. This is the other part of this, is when he's saying, like, it's... You shouldn't have Zach Brown digging around for a steering wheel. And I agree, like, in terms of title, like, probably not. But at the same time, there are elements of... racing is complicated. It's a lot of, like, team leadership and, like, keeping a lot of plates spinning and managing a lot of teams and knowing who to delegate to and then who to follow up with and when to check in and when to trust people, when not. There's a lot of that. But for me, the thing I still to this day do not understand is what exactly Zach Brown's involvement in all of this is. Because you see him, for a guy who says, I shouldn't be involved in like the nitty-gritty of some of the stuff with the racing, he is involved in that a great deal, right? Like, he's the guy who hops on the, you know, when they do the interview on the pit wall, they're talking to Zach Brown, usually, in terms of, like, team principal type stuff. So there's this weird element to me of Zach Brown has done a very good job of clearing out everyone else who isn't Zach Brown under the guise of like house cleaning, like housekeeping, and sort of reforming McLaren. The upshot of that has yet to materialize, but the other part of this is there are more and more things now that seem to belong like in Zach Brown's wheelhouse. And I'm getting less and less clear about what he is not responsible for, right? Like what he is not hands-on with, because basically everyone else who has a name to know at McLaren is basically gone. So now it's what, Zach and Jill DeFerrin? That's it. That's the part of this that I just increasingly find myself baffled by. When he sort of first appeared, he seemed more like business side, operations level guy, and now he's just everywhere, and it's like the reverse Midas.
Yeah, it's and considering like his background is in racing, so it's always been interesting to me where he
an advertiser.
Sorry, right? But I mean, he was a race driver for like 2 decades, so like he's like, it almost seems like maybe he's not the most qualified person to be like. Is delegation the issue? Is he just like, if he's the one looking in the buckets for steering wheels? Like, surely running a team like this, one of the most important things when you're head of the operation is making sure that you have the right officers underneath you. And that seems to be the common problem here, is that the buck stops before it gets to him, or someone else gets in trouble, or it was this communication over here. And it's like, okay, maybe he's not the right guy to be doing this.
Or he's trapped himself, because every time something goes wrong, he's like, ah, damn, just another person had to be like removed from that position. I'm sorry, I take responsibility. I wasn't involved enough. And so that's the story that, you know, he keeps telling. But also the result of that is, again, like, increasingly now in explaining these things, he makes more and more stuff accountable directly to him. And that also seems unsustainable for an operation of this complexity.
I think it'll go fine. It's a recipe for success.
I feel like we'll get a tell-all at some stage. Like, I don't think he is... He's not a calamitous, you know, in his position. It's just... these instances keep coming up, these like bizarre, and maybe, I don't know, maybe that's the folly of all motor racing, and we just got more insight into it because of the series, and this is a particularly embarrassing chapter, which played out in, I mean, like Hamilton, you know, or sorry, Alonso was like literally looking at the screen during qualifying with a million cameras around him while it was happening. Like, this played out in real time in front of everyone. So yeah, it's just, at a certain stage, McLaren needs to turn a corner, and if maybe Zach is at the wheel, it's not going to happen. I don't know. Maybe it's just a, maybe he is, has an impossible position, and the people who are underneath him, or the way the organization is set up, or whatever, it's just, you know, it's like fighting fire, and there's only so much work you can do. But it's, yeah, it's like Williams. You kind of, these problems seem to be just endemic in the organization, maybe, and maybe he's not helping that, but perhaps he's not also completely to blame for it.
Well, let's move on from one baffling CEO to another. Rich Energy.
I feel bad for Zach. This is like, that's not. that's a good segue. But this guy is like, this is Olympic level bullshittery,
really,
going on.
William Story, the CEO of Rich Energy, which is the title sponsor for Haas F1. Was interviewed by Peter Windsor, who is a Formula One journalist and former sporting director of the U.S. F1 team, interestingly. And in this interview on YouTube, which I can link as well, Richard Story comments on the ongoing lawsuit that they're fielding from White Bikes, who claim that Rich Energy stole their logo, which, boy, they sure look similar. But Story says, three different times, I've pulled some quotes here, their company I've never heard of before, an obscure bike company. Very few people have ever heard of them. No one's ever heard of this company. To which White Bikes, who make bicycles, by the way, not motorcycles, respond on Twitter. I'm just going to quote here. Let's have some fun with Mr. Story. # who's ever heard of White? How about the Rich Energy Haas F1 team driver, Roman Grosjean? Pictured here on the 26th of August, 2014, on a Lotus F1 team demo day on a white bike. And in the background is someone else wearing a White Bikes t-shirt with the logo on it. You can't write this stuff.
You couldn't make it up. It's a real slam dunk. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm shaken by this pool thing.
Okay.
Oh my God, the pool.
So, you could argue
that White's photoshopped the picture of Romain Grosjean, right? Because it seems too perfect. But, you know, but of course, that's not the case. Who would do that? Who would photoshop something to make a point? Who would photoshop something so banal? This is, I guess, the internet, being the internet, has done some sleuthing all over the Rich Energy Twitter account and found this awesome post from New Year's Day in 2019. A swim on New Year's Day with @RichEnergy. # 2019 goals. # love life. # business. Oh my God. And it's
that's from Rich Energy's Twitter account, right?
Yeah, which, by the way, this has 2 retweets and 14 likes. So Rich Energy not doing super hot on the social media there. Engagement. So it's effectively a picture of a very nice modern outdoor pool with the Rich Energy logo, at the bottom of the pool. So it's like a custom pool. And then here is a tweet from, I guess, whoever figured out the or did a scan of the picture or whatever. Let me make sure I get this one. This is from Lewis O. Jones, I believe. Yeah, Lewis Jones.
That's who pointed us to it.
Sorry,
yeah,
sent us to it. This is Conrad Keefe, who says, it then transpires that Rich Energy's passion for graphic design extends into its photoshopping skills too. A pool that is supposedly theirs, the logo at the bottom and all, turns out to be just another photo from the internet. It's basically a stock photo of a fiberglass pool. Or maybe one that was used on some website that makes pools or something. They've just taken this photo and then put their logo underneath it, which it like hurts my brain, because you could have done the tweet with the pool without the logo, and that would have been bad enough. But to go to the effort of doing like a transform tool to make the perspective that angle. Like I used
Danny,
to just be graphic design. It takes a while.
We're a worldwide brand and we're all about lifestyle. Okay. This is the lifestyle we're trying to portray here. It doesn't matter if it's not real.
This is the thing. The fact that you got an F1 team sponsored by a company that is basically doing like really trash it, like garbage tier Instagram influencer type stuff, trying to be like, oh yeah, just, you know, oh, just taking a swim in my pool. This is definitely like I definitely own at my mansion. That's definitely real.
Right. It's like, imagine like a mansion with the energy drink on it, or like a fucking airplane that looks like a can of the drink. It's like that level of absurd.
It's weird. I also, again, like, as long as the check's clear. As long as the check's clear, it's, you know, it, like, but at a certain point, if you're Haas, just, you know,
yeah,
I would smile, be vigorously searching for backup funding streams.
The fake Gunter Steiner Twitter account had a pretty funny response to it earlier today. I'll send it to you, Drew. You can stick it in the show notes.
Okay.
Amazing.
All right. Let's go from the theoretical to the wheel. To the real, I guess, and the wheel, if Zach Brown can find one. The W Series, now yes. Being hosted by NBC Sports Network in the U.S., so we can finally watch it without a VPN. Woo. Although, who knows? I mean, probably be lousy with commercials, but who knows? Maybe we'll be surprised. Jamie Chadwick, driver who is in the W Series, has been nominated as development driver for the Williams F1 team. She has joined the Driver Academy as a development driver, so congrats to her. And in other races in the Euro Formula Series, one Billy Monger, the Formula 4 driver who tragically lost his legs in a crash and has been on the way back to racing ever since, won a race.
Yeah.
He won a race, you guys. This guy is good. Then the full race, we will link in the show notes, because I've heard, even if you know the ending, it's still an amazing race. So I haven't watched it yet. Put that in the show notes for y'all. But from wherever that was to Monaco, take it away, Danny.
Sure. Yeah. Let's go to our favorite procession of the year, which I said last week. Monaco is an interesting circuit for us because it's generally the winner is whoever sort of polls. It's kind of, you know, the race is oftentimes, they say, it's won on the Saturday. But we love it, right? Like, I just, it's a special track. So many amazing races have happened here over the years. You know, the Prost Senna era, Patrese's miraculous win in 82, Graham Hill's dominance. There's just, it's one of the oldest races on the circuit, and we still kind of love it. A little bit of information about it. This will be the 76th running. It was first held in 1929. It's not really been changed all that much over the years in comparison to other tracks from the late 20s, I guess. It's about 80% the same, I'd say. The big difference happened, the first big change happened in 69 when they added the Armcore barriers. Philippe Vidal and Lorenzo Bandini, of course, who tragically died after the crash, both of them crashed in 67 and ended up in the straw bales, which went on fire. After Bandini's passing, they basically outlawed those and they added the Armco in 69. Alberto Ascari and Paul Hawkins, 10 years apart, went into the water there, which was another sort of reason in them trimming it up and making it a little bit safer. But in terms of the actual setup itself, it's mostly remained the same. Piscina and Raskas were added in 73. Sandevoet and Noge were tightened in 76, a couple years later. And then the chicane was added in 86. Chicane was added in 86. And we've seen the that's at the exit of the tunnel, you know, where they sort of come out there. It used to be a lot faster. So it was just a way of like making it a little bit less hectic around some of those faster turns like 12 and stuff. It's tough to overtake here. They take about 4,000 gear changes over the course of the track. It's super intense on the driver. There's one DRS straight. It's not very long on the start-finish straight. And in terms of overtaking opportunities, it's kind of few and far between. A lot of driver error to make stuff happen. People crashing, people missing apexes on Nouvelle Chicane. But for the first section of the, you know, sand of votes, sometimes people jump up the inside of it, maybe. Most of the big overtakes or position changes we've seen over the years have been from things like people clipping the walls or having bad pit stops in the case of Daniel Ricciardo. So it's a sort of a track that is, I don't know, it's either very boring or something very exciting happens, which sort of mixes it up. Yeah, it's also home to a bunch of people, as you know, ex-drivers and current drivers live there. It's a good place to train. There's no tax and no paparazzi are allowed. So rich people like living
there. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the paparazzi are, I don't know exactly what they do to stop them from doing it, but they're effectively outlawed. So everyone from Button and Coulthard have hotel, Coulthard owns a hotel there. Button lives there or has a place there. Gilles Villeneuve and Senna live there. Rosberg, Hamilton.
Ricardo, I think.
Yeah,
and Leclerc is from there.
Yeah, and Charles Leclerc is Monegasque. He's from there. Yeah, so
do you know much about? I always forget this story, but why we have a different schedule this weekend? Because it's, I think it used to be that the Prince of Monaco liked to shop on, was it Friday? So we have practice on Thursday.
It's Thursday. I forgot
about
it.
Maybe it's Saturday and qualifying on Friday. It's bizarre.
We talked about that before. I forget. I think the only race that was cancelled was 49 when Prince Louis II died just before it or something. I can't remember. I remember the current prince's wife. I'm not sure if they call her princess or how that all works. Monarchies fucking suck, says the Irish guy. She got like sprayed by champagne. Do you remember that? Like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
The whole podium, they seem really nice as well. But the whole podium thing is actually quite new as well. They used to just do like a Parc Fermé celebration before, but now they have that whole Prince's Box kind of thing, which is quite nice.
I was gonna say, I do not love this race in terms of like the racing I want to see. I should say though, in my view, I do think it is one of the most challenging tracks on the circuit. Like, you know, you'll hear people talk about there are like rhythm tracks or rhythm sections, and the idea being that there are certain sections, usually there are sections on courses where you can't actually just be reacting to things. You just need to be in a flow, and you basically need to be constantly like making steering inputs, just taking your cues from like the sense of the timing of the lap and not really relying on visual cues because they will mislead you, or they just won't, like reacting to them will throw you off and you will run an inefficient lap. Monaco is like that the entire way around. I cannot handle it. Like when I've raced this in like Sims, like for me, and I think for a lot of us, right, we're used to, you keep an eye out for like the corner markers and you sort of like, you take those as your cues. Monaco, because there are very few like actually straight sections, like everything is like bending, twisting slightly, you are always setting up for the next little adjustment. Monaco is such an intensely demanding track because you basically have to be inch perfect all the way around. And if you are thrown out of rhythm, you're totally screwed, right? You have to be like in this rhythm for the duration of the race, and any mistake will wipe you out. Like literally, I can't. This is a race when it comes up in like the F1 series, for instance. I basically just have to take the L because there are so many places where, you have to corner more tightly at this track than you do anywhere else on the circuit. There are places where, like, if you get it, if you cut it too shallow, you'll bang, and you see this all the time at the last hairpin, right? If you cut it too shallow, you'll bang the rear wheel into the, into the apex, and you're screwed. If you cut it too deep, you'll basically get lodged in the hairpin and have to be extracted.
Schumacher did that in qualifying on F1's top five. on their YouTube channel. They have like top five Monaco moments. And Schumacher, it's so funny watching the onboard because he just like whoop, 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 whoop. It's like a total Three Stooges moment because he crashes basically on purpose to yellow flag the qualifying session. And so he gets pole position. It's
How do I not remember? That's like Crashgate before Crashgate.
Yeah, that's pretty much.
Was Senna's off at turn eight at Portier there as well when he clipped the inside, and then he clipped the apex, then went and went into the wall just before the entrance to the tunnel, and kind of like Kimi got out and went to his boat. Senna got out and went to his apartment and didn't leave it for a couple of days.
We got the hard, medium, and soft here. C3, C4, C5, the softest compounds available. Not a lot of variation in the tire selections, although Ferrari and Red Bull are both taking one hard, one medium, and 11 softs. So,
soft
out. Guess we know where they're going. Weather-wise,
soft.
Qualifying and the race look to be very similar weather-wise. We're looking at mid-60s Fahrenheit or around 18, 19 Celsius. Relatively light wind, 7 to 8 miles an hour, around 11 kilometers an hour, and like 10% chance of precipitation. Should we take it to emails?
Sure. Do we have time for emails?
We have time for like one or two.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We got an interesting one. You kind of talked about the cars pipping around those corners. It reminded me a little bit about this issue that they used to have years ago when the track on the back wheels was wider than the front. And we actually got a really good question kind of about car length, because they used to, your front wheels would get through a corner in Monaco, but you kind of had to drift a little bit because the back wheel might collect it on the way, at least in those old cars. So we got this question from Matt Goulet, who says, we're always talking about boring races in F1, from the impossible to overtake races like Monaco to the races where there should be more overtaking. I find myself wondering if there isn't a simple new rule to bring in to resolve this. Maximum car length. Formula One cars now lie somewhere between 4 to 5 meters, that's 13 to 16 feet long, and they seem to grow every year. The tracks aren't changing, though, and I wonder if that's why overtaking has taken such a huge dive over recent seasons. If the FIA FOM institute a maximum allowed car length of just 3.5 meters, just over 11 feet, it would dramatically reduce the turning radius of the cars and mean that a car isn't impossible to get alongside of and overtake. Do you think this would work to increase overtaking? What else do you think might work? And I did some research myself and found an interesting video on Reddit that sort of showed the track and wheelbase of cars changing. I guess track being the distance between the left and right tires, and wheelbase being the difference between the front and rear tires. And it sort of demonstrated the distance between them, how it's evolved over, say, the past 50 years. So, it starts off with a Lotus 68, which has a wheelbase and track of wheelbase of 2.6 meters and a track of 1.5, and then you bring it up to a modern day Mercedes. I think the Mercedes is mentioned here. Which has I guess let's go over 99 Ferrari, even 3.2 wheelbase and a 1.4 track. So it's an interesting, I guess, there are no easy answers to things in F1, and obviously aerodynamics and car speed and all of these things play a part, but what do you guys think of the idea of shortening the cars again? I also wonder if there's a safety issue involved in this, in dispersing the energy.
I just don't think it's turning radius. I think it's aero.
Right.
I think the aero is one of the reasons the cars are so long. But also, necessity of making the cars safer. You hear drivers talk about sitting in the old F1 cars just like wreathed in fuel. That was the old model, and so now there are so many safety measures about sort of keeping the survival cell of the car intact and safe that I fundamentally think this is probably, I don't think you're going to get I don't think you're going to recover that much of that space and stay within safety regulations. But also, I don't think that this is the factor that's keeping us from getting overtaking. I think it is just the degree of aerodynamic sophistication that is now the norm in the sport.
Yeah, I'm all for gigantic cars. I want them to make them as large as they can and try to have them squeeze around the circuit. And
what was that? It doesn't make concept problem. That was like six wheels?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I wonder what the average length of an Indy car is against an F1 car. You know, it's we see those guys. What was that famous race a couple of years ago where there were six abreast coming over the line or whatever?
Yeah.
Not doing that in Monaco.
Another quick question. During Baku, when Leclerc crashed in Quali and they red flagged it for a bit, the same buddy asked, what would happen if they were unable to restart Quali? I assured him, I guess he's talking to his friend. This is from Graydon, by the way. I assured him they would, but it was a fair question. What if qualifying got red flagged because of weather or something like that? Genuinely threatened Saturday's events during, say, Q2. What would happen? What would the starting grid look like? Has that ever happened?
Wasn't there a red flagged quali in Malaysia like years ago? Because that was an issue where I know that there was a wild qualifying where they basically red flagged it because of a monsoon blowing through. But right. I think they might have already logged some laps, so you ended up with a weird grid, but you did have a quali session with times.
Weird grid. I'm on a weird grid every week. Let's just take a
weird grid.
Yeah, let's just do it by like age, sometimes, you know, alphabet, surnames, order, descending, ascending, mix it up.
I would bet that, yeah, if you probably your fastest time logged during that session would just become your qualifying time. And they would go down the list like that. I think if you like somehow had to cancel qualifying, they'd probably do your practice times. I did a cursory look through the FIA regulations and I couldn't find a way to do that. But that's kind of how MotoGP works. You go out for practice and depending on your practice times, you are sectioned into either Q1 or Q2. So that's my guess on that. All right, Rob, I know you got to take off for a sec, but thanks for joining us, Mr. Sackney.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. And I am going to be on a family vacation, so I'm not even going to get to watch Monaco. I will miss the entire parade.
Wait a second. I'll be out next week, too.
Yeah, we talked about this a while ago, I think. It's going to be Danny's one-man show off-Broadway.
Everyone's favorite Shift F1 contributor, me, of course.
Yeah.
The most knowledgeable one.
1 week only.
Yeah, well, I'll be bringing in a ringer in a what do you call it, our reserve driver, as it were.
Yeah, there you go.
We just to help make sure it's the right shade of orange. I can't wait to come back and discover that we have a YouTube channel now, and it's Danny O'Dwyer reacts to 2019 Monaco Grand Prix.
We literally do Let's Plays on the Patreon on a YouTube channel, so we're not that far, are we?
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Rob.
All right, take care, guys. Bye.
Cheers.
All right, Danny. From Monaco to the rest of the world, what do you say we take it to?
Race around the world.
Some good racing going on. I'm feeling good about Formula 2. I'm feeling good about W Series.
Yeah.
I guess I got to start watching Euro Formula now. The Billy Monger's winning races.
Right, we had the Northwest was on last week for the bikes, and the big one's coming up this week.
That's right, baby, more bikes coming up. I guess I'll just mention that right now since we're talking about it. The Isle of Man TT, which we just did a whole Patreon podcast about the Isle of Man TT. I'm definitely going to try to watch some of this. I don't think it's airing anywhere in the US, but VPNs are a great way to secure your internet traffic. Apropos of nothing, and if you're in the UK, you can watch it on itv.com with a free account that you can create there. So also a good idea to change your time zone on your computer just periodically, you know, to the UK whenever
change
whenever
it up, just mix it up, you know.
Yeah, just mix it up. Keep guessing. Formula 2 will be supporting the Formula 1 race in Monaco this weekend. We've also got Formula E in Berlin. Supercars will be at Winton Raceway in Victoria, Australia. IndyCar, the 103rd running of the Indianapolis 500, is also this weekend. It always seems to coincide with the Monaco race.
Yeah.
So
literally going back decades, there are drivers back in the 50s, I think, who couldn't race a Monaco because the Indy was on. So it's
probably Montoya, but I think they've flown between Monaco and I think some brilliant. Drivers have done the double. Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Motocross GP is in France at Moto Club Enguerrin. It's definitely not how you pronounce that. The World Rallycross Championship is at Silverstone for the Day Insure World Rallycross of Great Britain. Super GT! Their round three is at the Suzuka Circuit in Inuocho. Inuocho, Suzuka, Mie Prefecture, Japan.
Japan.
And we got NASCAR.
Oh my God.
And NASCAR. And F1.
Oh, you bet. We got the Xfinity Series, which is like NASCAR Junior. They're racing the Alsco 300. I don't know what that
Alsco is. Alsco in Love and War.
Indeed. And we got the regular old NASCAR, Monster NASCAR Cup. Both of those are at Charlotte Motor Speedway, and the Monsters will be racing the Coca-Cola 600. It's a real weekend of America.
Yeah, this is probably the hottest week in motorsports in the world. Whether you want
really
two wheels or four wheels, open wheels, closed wheels, we got your back.
me and Rob will both be out, so it's perfect.
Dude, everyone's on family vacations. My parents are here right now.
Oh, that's crazy.
I'm going to a wedding in Cape Cod on Sunday, so I'm probably also going to miss the race live.
Wow.
Depending on how the hotel internet works out, I guess.
Well, we got practice kicking off Thursday, as mentioned, May 23rd at 5 a.m. Eastern Time on ESPN2. Same with practice 2, which is at 9 a.m. Practice 3 is on Saturday, May 25th at 6 a.m. on ESPN2, followed by qualifying at 9 a.m. Also ESPN2. And the race, Danny.
The race.
Sunday, May 26th at 9 a.m. on ESPN. With an encore on ABC the same day at 3:30 p.m. If you don't have ESPN, you can watch it over the air on ABC.
Awesome. And if you're hankering for some Monaco action, the Formula E Monaco race already happened a couple of weeks back, and the highlights are on YouTube, so you can go watch that as well.
Oh, nice.
Cool. Although it's basically just Sector 1 and 2. Oh, no, it's not. It's basically just Sector 3.
Okay.
That's actually how it works. Yeah, it's very strange.
If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/shiftf1. Get access to all our weird bonus episodes, podcasts, videos, etc. Yeah, that's it for me. I'll catch the race somehow. I won't be there for the podcast, but I'm looking forward to watching Formula One. I know it's not going to be a good race because Monaco never is. But I don't know. There's something about the pageantry, the history of Monaco. It's just a fun circuit to look at, I think.
Yeah, I always look forward to Monaco. I like you said, I don't. It's something just about the event. It's a real fun weekend to celebrate F1 in all of its ridiculousness. I got an early taste of the feeling of speed and aerodynamics earlier today. I was on a walk in the park, and the Blue Angels flew over our head.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah, it's Memorial Day weekend, I guess, and I live in Annapolis, so they're practicing today for the big show on Monday. So yeah, we were just walking through a park, and suddenly this tearing noise through the sky. We looked up, and four of them banked, like not that high above us. We could almost see the pilots' heads. It was pretty incredible. So I got the need for speed. I'm looking forward to the weekend.
Fantastic. Well, have a good race weekend, everyone. Danny, we'll see you all next week.
Meow.